In this last session, I'd like to finish with looking at how we can integrate both the shamatha and vipassana practice into our daily life. Because if we don't know how to apply these practices and integrate them into daily life, then they remain some sort of abstract theoretical concept that don't really help us. So I'd like to try to give some information and guidance on how we can best do that. And I'd like to start by, and this comes up in the context of shamatha practice, how to set up a conducive sort of lifestyle to support practice. So not only should we, if we're doing some sort of meditative practice, then not only do we need to meditate on a particular topic in the morning, but we need to bring that into the day. So that's what I'm going to talk about after. But first, we need also to have a sort of framework of our life to support those two activities. Because, as I mentioned earlier, now in our modern-day society, mindfulness is getting very popular, being popularized. But unfortunately, then mindfulness has been taken out of context and everything else has been stripped away, particularly ethics. You know, that ethics, we don't want that stuff. That's religious stuff. And so then people end up with this sort of very bare mindfulness practice and there's no framework. And so then it simply ends up as a sort of a little bit of medicine to try and soothe our tormented mind. And then it doesn't work very well because we have a dysfunctional lifestyle. And so that little bit of medicine is not going to sort that out. So we need to have a framework for practice. And so within the shamatha practice, then there are usually six things that are mentioned. The first is a supportive environment. And here, usually there are listed a number of things, you know, in terms of having a good location, not too noisy, and a healthy place, and so forth. But one thing that's mentioned in here is to have what's called sometimes good friends. And so this really brings up the idea of sangha. And I think I tend to emphasize this more and more now because, you know, often people come to these sort of talks or Buddhist courses and they see lots of good ideas and then they think, wow, that could really help me in my life. I'm going to go home and I'm going to implement these ideas and transform my life. And probably 9 times out of 10 or more, we fail miserably, myself included. And often the reason is when we go back home, we're trying to do all this by ourselves. And we've got all of our bad habits, we have a lot of influences around us that are pushing us sort of in the opposite direction that we want to try to go. And we're not very strong-minded, and we're easily influenced by all these conditions and other people, and we just get swept up in our old habits and behaviour. And this really happened to me years ago when I first came to Buddhism. I did a course, I got very excited about it. I went to Kopan Monastery in Kathmandu, did a 1 month course. And then I thought, okay, I'll go back home. I want to really change my life, head my life in a new direction. I went home and I wanted to do this, but for 2 years, nothing happened. I just got swept up in my old habits, no matter how much I wanted to change, because I was too weak-minded. I just got swept away through my friends and work and so forth. Nothing happened for 2 years. It was only really when I extracted myself from that and I found myself in a situation where there was some sangha, some like-minded people who I was trying to do something similar. So I think for many of us, as a beginner, this is very important, if not essential, because we need to get associated with other like-minded people, get some support and help them as well to have some momentum to bring us forward. Of course, as we develop in the practice, then we can become a little bit more self-sufficient. But as a beginner, the idea of sangha, I think, is critical. Of course, if it's a Buddhist center like this, this is great. You know, they have a very vibrant community here, a lot of things going on, so you can attend things and meditate together and follow courses and so forth. But maybe you're not in a place where there's an organized center. So then at least I think it's important to find some other people, a group of people who are trying to do something similar and get associated with them and come together on a regular basis, at least once a week, to talk or meditate and so forth. And so from my experience and many people I talk to, if we don't have some sort of form of sangha in the beginning phase, it's nearly impossible to really transform our life, unless we happen to be a very strong-minded sort of person. So I think this is something we really need to think about if we really want to implement some of these ideas and change our life for the better. Then the next two things are related. And that is to have few desires and being content. And of course, this is talking about material things. So, of course, if we are caught up in the idea that happiness is coming from out there, therefore I need more money, more stuff, more sense pleasures, then we're not going to be able to devote time and energy to developing ourselves. We're just going to be spending all of our time chasing after that happiness that seems to be out there and trying to avoid the suffering that seems to be out there. So we're not going to have any time to meditate or anything like this. So we need to really appreciate here that more stuff doesn't mean more happiness. In fact, recently I saw a study where they had they had a graph of wealth and happiness. And so as you would expect, if you have no money, then you can hardly survive. So what they found was that in the initial phases, it went like this. But then what they found was very interesting. When they got to a point here of wealth, which was enough to provide our basic necessities of life, then rather than going like this, what they found was that if you get more wealth, after that point, the happiness level goes like that. So this is what they found, is that, of course, we need a minimum amount of wealth and material things to have some basic level of survival. But if we are searching for more and more wealth, we're not going to be more and more happy. In fact, the study showed that it sort of reduced. In fact, associated with that, there was another study where this person interviewed billionaires about their level of happiness. And pretty well across the board, they said they weren't happy. But what was strange was that on average, they said if they had 25% more money, they'd be more happy. They still were holding on to that idea that the reason they weren't happy was because they didn't have enough money, and that if they had 25% more, that was the average, they'd be more happy. So, anyway. So I think if we can really appreciate, of course we need, pretty well most of us need to work to earn money to have a roof over our head and so forth. But if we're constantly chasing after more stuff, then we're really going in the wrong direction. So few desires is in terms of things that we don't have, and being content is with respect to the things we do have. This, of course, is in terms of material stuff. In terms of spiritual practice, it's exact opposite. In spiritual practice, we should have a lot of desire, a lot of aspiration, and never be content with the level we're at.
While I'm on that point, just one thing I want to mention about this word desire.
You know, we talked about we have to eliminate attachment. And so sometimes that's translated as desire. And then sometimes people, when they hear this, they go, well, if I get rid of all of this desire and attachment, I'm not going to have any passion for anything. I'm going to be lifeless. I'm just going to be like a vegetable. I'm not going to have any drive to do anything. So one of the problems here is this, again, the word desire. And in Buddhism, you'll find sometimes the word desire meaning attachment. In that context, of course, we need to get rid of all desires. We need to get rid of all attachment. But sometimes the word desire is also used to mean aspiration. For example, bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is the aspiration for enlightenment for the welfare of others. Sometimes that's listed as the desire for enlightenment for the welfare of others. Of course, we're not talking about becoming attached to enlightenment. Attachment to anything is going to cause problems. Attachment to meditation, spiritual practice, enlightenment will cause problems. So, therefore, desire in terms of aspiration for something worthwhile, we need to increase. Passion in terms of aspiration for something worthwhile, we need to increase. Passion in terms of a craving and attachment, we need to decrease and get rid of. So we need to keep this in mind. Otherwise, we sort of, when we see this, we think that we'll have no drive, no passion, no ambition to achieve anything. So these, again, go together. And then related to that, the fourth point is few activities, meaning that if we really want to meditate and integrate these things in our life and devote ourselves to improving ourselves in our life, then we need to simplify our life. Again, there are a number of activities that most of us need to do every day. Probably most of us need to work, need to go shopping and, you know, do these activities. But beyond these essential activities, then often what we do is we fill up our life with lots of stuff, lots of activities. And usually there's two reasons for that. One is that in our society it's felt that if you're not doing something, you're not being productive. So we have to do something to be productive. And secondly, of course, what often happens is if we're not doing anything and we're just sitting there, it sort of forces us to look at our mind, and we certainly don't like what we see, so it's a big mess. So we just have to distract ourselves, we busy ourselves, so we don't have to look at our own mind. So, because of that, then, you know, when we come into the spiritual path, often people go say, oh, I'd like to meditate, but I don't have any time. I've got no time to meditate. I think that's never a valid excuse. It's simply a matter of priorities. Of course, if we've filled up our life with lots of extra meaningless stuff, sure, we won't have time to meditate. One solution, I think, rather than forcibly cutting things out of our life, because if we just forcibly cut them out, we're still going to be having attachment to them and we're going to have a struggle. There's always going to be a struggle of forcibly pushing it out, doing some meditating and then going back to it. So I think that's not a good solution. Rather, what we need to do, of course, is to really look at our lives and what is important in our lives. And so here in Buddhism, a couple of the very good reflections to do to help us with this is the first two reflections is precious human life and death. So to reflect on this precious human life we have, this life of wonderful opportunity that we can do a lot of good things in our life, and death, the fact it's not going to last forever. Because if we just reflect on precious human life, then people say, yeah, I know, I want to make my life meaningful. Yes, it's important to do spiritual stuff, but I'm busy now with my family and career and stuff. I'll do that spiritual stuff later when I retire. And of course, we just keep putting it off and off and off, and we never begin. So what we need to do is important is to reflect on death, that this precious opportunity is not going to last forever. We don't know how long it's going to last. And if we can really reflect on death, then what you will find is that you're just going to simply lose interest in these extra activities that bring no meaning, because you'll see through them and you'll see that they're such a waste of time, and you don't want to waste your time because you don't know how much time you'll have left. And actually on that point, I've got a nice little quote here from Steve Jobs, who I think most of you know, used to be the CEO of Apple, of course, company here. And it's an address he gave to students at Stanford University about 10 years ago. And part of that, he says the following here. He said, "When I was 17, I read a quote that went something like, 'If you live each day as if it were your last, someday you'll most certainly be right.'" And he says, "It made an impression on me. And since then, for the past 33 years, I have looked in the mirror every morning and asked myself, if today were the last day of my life, would I want to do what I'm about to do today? And whenever the answer has been no for too many days in a row, I know I need to change something. Remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations or pride or fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. Remembering that you are going to die is the best way I know to avoid the trap of thinking you have something to lose. You are already naked. There is no reason not to follow your heart." So I think that's some very good advice there. And we see this so much in that, you know, people who've had a direct experience of death, people who've had near-death experiences, they've seen death directly and come back, often their lives are completely transformed. From that experience, they can really appreciate what the preciousness of life, and it's not going to last forever. And very often they're full of joy and enthusiasm and really take the most out of their life. Also, sometimes then people who have terminal illnesses. I had a person on a course some years ago who's working in the hospice movement, and she was looking after terminally ill people. And she said it was very common that if the person got to the point of accepting their death, going past the sort of anger and denying, that if they got to that point, even if they only had 3 or 6 months to live, she said it wasn't uncommon for them to then tell her that this terminal illness was the best thing that ever happened to them in their whole life, because they can, for the first time, really appreciate the preciousness of life, and then they really want to make most use of what time they have left. So I think we don't need to go through those life-threatening illnesses or near-death experiences. If we simply meditate on precious human life and death and really internalize that, we can end up with the same aspiration to really make our life meaningful. And then I think you'll find that you will just, a lot of these extra activities that you are useless to us, you just drop away. We'll just lose interest in them, and then you're going to have a lot more time and energy for meditating, for developing yourself, and providing benefit in the society. The next point is ethical lifestyle. So I think the basis of any spiritual tradition, I think the basis of any meaningful life needs to be ethical lifestyle. If we're not engaging in ethical lifestyle, if we're engaging in a lot of harmful activity, harming others, we're just going to have a lot of unnecessary suffering and receive more unnecessary suffering. And it's going to agitate the mind. It's really not conducive at all. And then the last point is to eliminate compulsive thinking. All of us tend to obsess or have compulsive thinking about certain things. And this sort of complete compulsive obsessive thinking about things, of course, just torments our mind. And so we need to notice when this sort of obsessive compulsive thinking comes up and really let it go as much as possible, because it's not very conducive to any sort of spiritual practice. So these are the 6 points that are mentioned usually in the context of shamatha practice, particularly if we want to sort of dedicate time and effort to shamatha practice in the form of retreat, to have these sorts of conditions. But I think we can apply these conditions in general in our daily life, that if we can find these sorts of conditions, then that's going to be a good basis for entering into some sort of spiritual practice and making our life more meaningful. Any questions about any of those 6 points? I think most of them are fairly self-explanatory. Okay. So then... Sorry, I didn't catch something about precious human life and death.
I said you put that down on the wall.
Yeah. So that was related to this point, is that, yeah, because, you know, often, like I said, when we tend to have very busy lives in our modern society, full of stuff, and so then, you know, we often, the excuse is, oh, I'm too busy to meditate. But the problem is our priorities are wrong. You know, we're thinking that all this activities and stuff is going to lead to happiness. But whereas if we can really appreciate that, you know, that all this stuff out here is not going to bring us any genuine lasting happiness. At most, they can give us some transient pleasure. And so, therefore, if we really understand our precious human life, the wonderful opportunity we have, and it's not going to last forever, then we're not going to want to waste our life. We want to make it as meaningful as possible, and thereby a lot of these extra activities that bring us no meaning will just drop away. We'll lose interest in them, and we'll just focus on the important things in our life. In fact, there is another very well-known list of things on the internet from a lady, Australian lady who was in the hospice movement, and over 20 or 30 years she was asking people, terminally ill people, what were their biggest regrets in life were. And the number one regret for all, this was over the last 20 or 30 years, and probably at that time predominantly men were in the workforce and not so much women, but she said that the number one regret pretty well for every male patient she had was they regretted working too hard. Number one regret. And not spending enough time with family and friends and doing other things. That was the number one regret pretty well for every male patient she had over a 20-year period. So I think we don't want to be a person that later in our life has that regret. So if we can really think about our life, prioritize our life, and then we can really make our life meaningful. Okay. Then some general advice now in terms of shamatha practice, vipassana practice, but practice in general. One which I mentioned briefly is expectation. Expectations is really going to create a lot of unnecessary frustration in our practice. Particularly the expectation that simply some sort of intellectual understanding of a topic will change our life. It won't. I mean, maybe slightly, but if... And so there's a danger that in the spiritual path we just read books, attend classes, we're gathering more and more intellectual stuff, and that's all we do. And then we sort of feel comfortable with that. I think if that's what we do, we're going to be very much disappointed, because I think our life won't really change much at all, and we're just going to become very frustrated. So remember, if we really want these ideas to help us in our life, we need to bring that intellectual understanding through reading and classes. We need to bring it into practice, into experience, through meditating, internalizing, and integrating into daily life. Then we'll start to notice some change in our life. And in terms of change, we're talking about inner transformation. We're talking about transforming our mind. Often unfortunately, what people do is when they get into some Buddhist spiritual path or something, they make it a big external display. You know, sometimes you see them wearing funky Buddhist clothing and shaving head and wearing all the paraphernalia and making a big display of it. And it's often a sign that they're not really being sincere about their practice. And of course, if we make a big outward display about it, particularly if we're coming from a family or community that's a little bit conservative, we're just going to have a lot of friction and unnecessary problems. So it's often recommended that we really just work on inner change and not really make a big outward display about it. Because outward display is a sign of a big ego trip. We're just putting on a spiritual ego clothes. We're just becoming spiritual ego, and often spiritual ego is one of the worst because we become very obnoxious and very superior feeling, you know, I'm very spiritual, you're not, you're just this mundane person, I'm better than you. And this is very, very not nice, and we notice that when we're around people like that, they're not very nice to be with. Also, there's a very nice quote I like, and because really in the spiritual path for transforming ourselves, one of the signs that we're really progressing or we can see progress in others is humility. And so there's a very nice quote I like that says, the harvest of good qualities does not grow on the rocky peaks of pride. So of course, you can't grow any crops on rocky peaks. They grow in the low fertile valleys. Likewise, the harvest of good qualities in our mind doesn't grow on rocky peaks of pride and arrogance. It grows in the low, fertile valley of humility. And as I mentioned also, the idea of sangha is that, you know, we start to go into some course or teaching, or we get some little ideas sprouting in our mind, you know, new ideas that we'd like to implement. So it's a little bit like a little shoot, you know, has sprouted. If we want that little shoot to grow into a healthy crop, of course we need to protect it and nurture it. So likewise, if we have some ideas sprouting in our mind, we need to protect those and we nurture them. So again, sangha for this, I think, is very, very important. If we try to do it on our own, there's a very much danger that these little ideas will just get simply squashed by all the negative influences around us in our daily life. Also, as I mentioned with the few activities to simplify our life, related to that is, you know, often I get people asking, should I do the career thing or the spiritual thing, you know? And often people think that to have a sort of meaningful life, I have to abandon my career. I think this usually is not a good idea. Because if we abandon our career, then how are we going to financially support ourselves? What are we going to do out with ourselves? Particularly if it's a career where we have some talent, then what we need to do, of course, is not, it's not a choice, it's a matter of integration. We need to use our talents and make them more useful to benefit society. Like, for example, I had recently in one of my courses, I had an Indian man who was in marketing, and you know, he said he was very good at marketing. He didn't tell me what he was marketing, but probably not something very meaningful. And he had this big quandary, you know, he was thinking about giving up marketing and just going into some sort of spiritual life. And I said, no, don't do that, because what are you going to do, you know? You're obviously very talented at this, so rather use your talents in a better way. So, you know, use your marketing talents and market something useful like, you know, solar power, solar energy or something like this. So use your talents to make a positive impact in life. Because if we abandon our talents, then we can't be very effective in helping others in society. So rather we need to integrate the two. Of course, if we're doing a job or career that we're only doing because it gives us a lot of money and we really hate it and so forth, then we may think about maybe changing that. But if we're in a career that we have some a talent and ability, then much better to try and work on trying to use that talent for a better purpose in society, for in helping society in a better way. Then also, I mentioned in I think already on Friday evening, that the key to success is continuity. Continuity, of course, means daily practice. But remember, practice is not just sitting down and meditating for a certain amount of time every day. Practice is meditation plus what we do for the rest of the day. So if we want success or progress in any practice, we need to have a formal meditation practice where we internalize what we're meditating, what we're trying to develop, and then the rest of the day we need to try and integrate that into our daily life. So practice includes meditation and what we do between meditation sessions. And so on that note, how can we sort of set up our day? In terms of daily meditation practice, generally it's recommended to do this first thing in the morning, because that's when usually we're most fresh. We can really we can set aside that time, and usually it's most quiet where we live. And it's also, of course, it's a very good way to start the day. If we decide that we want to do our daily meditation practice in the evening, for many of us that would be very problematic. We have a lot of social engagements in the evening, often very tired from work and so forth. So if we do the meditation practice first thing in the morning, usually that's the best. And with meditation practice, particularly shamatha practice, but in general, one of the key phrases is quality over quantity. It's much better to meditate a short time with focus rather than a long time and just sit there and get spaced out and distracted and dull. So therefore, particularly in the shamatha practice, is to have short sessions as a beginner. How long to meditate? That depends a little bit on us as an individual, our level of capacity. But one measure of knowing how long to meditate as a beginner is our enthusiasm to meditate the same at the end as it was at the beginning? If our enthusiasm is dropping off, we're meditating too long. But often a good ballpark figure for a beginner, 20, 25 minutes or so. But again, for some of us that may be a bit long, for some of us maybe we can meditate longer. So we have to sort of work that out for ourselves. And with the meditation sessions, it's best to have a fixed amount of time. Well, first off, the time where you meditate each day, it's best to have the same time. Because one of the most difficult things is just to develop a habit. If we keep changing the time when we meditate, we're not really developing a habit. So modern studies have shown that we need to do something at least 25 or 30 times before we even start to develop a habit. So if we can really make a fixed time each morning that we meditate, then it just becomes a habit that every morning at whatever, 6 or 6:30, we meditate. And have a fixed amount of time. The reason for that, there's at least two reasons to have a fixed amount of time. One is that if we don't have a fixed amount of time, then on a particular morning we sit down to meditate and things are not going very well. Maybe we're half asleep or very agitated and distracted, it's very difficult. Then the tendency would be simply to stop. So then, of course, if after 5 or 10 minutes we simply stop because it's not going well, then we're remaining the slaves of our mind. Our mind is dictating to us. So this is, we need to develop perseverance in the spiritual path. So this is not helping us to develop perseverance. So if we have a fixed amount of time, then maybe we set a little clock with an alarm, or on the mobile phone set the alarm for 20 minutes or whatever, then if it's a difficult morning, then we'll persevere. So we'll develop perseverance. And the other side of it is that on days when things are going very well and we don't set an amount of time, then what happens, of course, is if things are going very well, what do? We just keep going because things are going well. And how long do we keep going? Until they don't go well, until they start to go bad. And then we stop. And the thing we remember most about meditation session is how it ended. So if we're always ending on dullness and distraction and agitation, we start to associate meditation with these bad experiences. We're not going to want to meditate again. Whereas if we have a fixed amount of time, the alarm goes off and things are going well, we stop, that's what we remember. And then we'll be enthusiastic to meditate the following day because we'll remember, oh, that was a good experience actually. Because the thing we remember most is how it ended. So this is some good advice in terms of time and length of meditation. Then what to meditate on, of course. There are many things to meditate on in the morning. But again, I think as a beginner, particularly if we find our mind is quite prone to dullness and distraction, which probably is the case for many of us, then I think a major component of our morning practice, it's good to have shamatha practice, to develop a calm, clear, focused mind. And then again, what object to use in our shamatha practice? The one that works best for you. But of course, I think it's important not just to do shamatha practice and that's all we do. That's a little bit imbalanced. I think it's also very good and very helpful to add in some at least loving kindness and compassion practice to have that balance in our practice. So some mornings we could then maybe just start with a little bit of shamatha and then do a loving kindness compassion practice. Other days we can mainly just do some sort of shamatha practice, or also of course add in a little bit of vipassana practice as well. Also what can be very helpful in a practical way in the morning meditation is that if there is a situation or coming up in the day where we anticipate that there's going to be a difficult situation that we may react in a very negative, bad way, then what we can do is rehearse that situation in the morning. We can, you know, maybe we're going to meet a work colleague or our boss and we anticipate there's going to be some friction or difficulty and we may find that we're going to get angry at them or react or something. Then what we can do is to rehearse how we would like that difficult situation to unfold in our day. So if we rehearse that a little bit, then we may find that when we come to that difficult situation, we sort of a little bit remember that and maybe it'll go a little bit in a bit better way during the day. Then, of course, we need to bring what we meditate on into the day. So one of the key elements here, of course, is mindfulness. So this is why also shamatha practice can be very helpful in the morning, because it helps to strengthen our mindfulness. So, of course, we can simply say at the beginning of the day, I'm going to try to be as mindful as possible in everything I do. But probably very shortly afterwards we'll forget that and we won't. So what can be helpful in helping us to develop mindfulness throughout the day is to have what's called triggers. Have certain events in the day that trigger us, remind us to be mindful. So we can pick certain events in the day where we make a conscious effort to really be present. A classic example, of course, is brushing our teeth. Usually in the morning, of course, we're sort of running late, we're gulping down breakfast, rushing and brushing the teeth very quickly. While we're brushing the teeth, we're thinking about all the things we have to do that day, and then we start to rush out the door and then we go, did I brush my teeth or not? And we don't even remember. So therefore, we can pick certain things like brushing the teeth and say, okay, whenever I'm brushing the teeth, I'm going to be totally present with that, with the sensations of the toothbrush on the gums and so forth, and not be doing that and thinking about something else. And that related to that is this idea of multitasking. Multitasking is an illusion. It is not effective, particularly at our level of mindfulness and attention skills. So this idea that multitasking is helpful actually has been proven to be false. That we cannot multitask flipping from one task to the other. All we end up doing is doing every task not very efficiently. So we need to be really present in whatever we are doing and not flipping backwards and forwards, because that also produces a lot of agitation and stress and tension as well. Also, of course, what we can do in the day in terms of a trigger is we can use now on the smartphones there are many apps, that little mindfulness apps that would at random interval during the day give some little alarm or signal on the mobile phone. They maybe even have associated with that some little mindfulness exercise. If not, then when we hear that little alarm go off on our mobile phone, then we simply stop whatever we do and then do a little mindfulness exercise. Maybe simply focusing on our breath for three short breaths, or just simply looking at our mind for a minute or two. So some little mindfulness exercise like this, you'll be surprised, just doing a few of these through the day, how we start to get in the habit of being mindful. So this, we can use modern technology to help us to improve our mindfulness throughout the day. Then, of course, in daily life as well, then what can be very helpful here is, in terms of our loving kindness, compassion and vipassana practice, is that when we are faced with difficult situations, to avoid this cognitive fusion. That if we see someone behaving in a negative or bad way, to avoid this cognitive fusion and seeing there's a bad person. Rather, see, there's a person there who, just like me, trying to be happy, and they believe that this behaviour is the way to happiness. In fact, it's just creating a lot of suffering for themselves and others. And so if we can avoid that, then instead of reacting to these difficult situations with anger and hatred and so forth, we can use compassion in these difficult situations, try and help that person and not accept their bad behaviour. So this, I think, can be very helpful. Another thing related to this that I briefly mentioned, I think, earlier today, is when we see difficult situations in our life, what we tend to do is we label that difficult situation as a problem. Soon as we label a difficult situation as a problem, automatically we go, ah, problem. I don't like problems. I don't want problems. Go away. So we instantly kicks in aversion. And by having aversion to problems, we magnify them. They get magnified. They become huge. And they torment us. So rather than seeing a difficult situation as a problem, we should see it as an opportunity. In fact, if we really look at our lives, when were the times where we most developed as a person? Usually it's not when our life is flowing easily. Usually if our life is flowing easily, we just drift along and nothing, we don't develop. It's only when we're faced with a difficult situation that challenges that we really develop as a person. So, and this is the case in business. I mean, when someone, a business person faces a difficult situation, when they see it as a problem, they often fail. If they see it as an opportunity, that's when they often succeed, because it challenges them to change and improve. So likewise, in our daily life, if we're faced with a difficult situation in our life, if we can really see it as an opportunity and it's not as a problem, we won't magnify the difficultiness, we won't have aversion, and we'll try and work through that difficult situation, and we can learn from that and improve as a person. So I think this can also be very helpful in our daily life. Also, I think it's very good to finish our day on a good note. Of course, if we have time and energy and we want to do a second meditation each day in the evening, great, fantastic, good. Many of us, maybe that's going to be difficult. Maybe we're quite tired, or we have a lot of social activities in the evening, or responsibilities, family responsibilities or so forth. But I think there's at least two things we can do at the end of each day, all of us. The first thing that is very helpful is to, before we go to bed, is to review our day. How did our day go? And if we noticed that there were certain negative things we did during the day, we maybe said some very negative things or did some harmful things, then we can purify that negative action. And within Buddhism, there are really four things that we can do to help purify our mind of these negative behaviours. The first, of course, is to have regret, to have sincere regret for that action. Of course, if we do cognitive fusion, will simply feel guilty. Bad me, bad me. So we want to avoid cognitive fusion and simply acknowledge, okay, today I did that harmful thing. I acknowledge that. I regret having done that negative action. So that already is purifying that negative behaviour. So the first is regret. Then the second is to reaffirm the positive direction we follow in our life. Sometimes it's called reliance. Reliance is to reaffirm the positive direction we want to follow in our life. In the Mahayana Buddhism, that often takes the form of, you know, going for refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and reaffirming this bodhicitta aspiration. But if we're not Buddhist, then at least we can make, you know, an affirmation that I want to lead a good life, I want to try and help others. Just to reaffirm the positive direction we want to follow our life. That's the second thing. The third thing is what's called remedy. Remedy is to think of some sort of practical remedy for that negative action. For example, let's say we verbally abuse someone during the day. Then the remedy could be, say, okay, tomorrow morning I'm going to apologize to them. So if we can do some positive opposite action, the best. If that's not practical, then at least some positive action with a motivation of wishing to overcome that negative behavior can be effective as well. The fourth thing is what is called resolve, or there's another restraint. And that is to make a strong determination not to do that negative behavior again. Now with this, we need to be also practical with the resolve. For example, if we're the sort of person that tends to tell quite a lot of lies, then if we notice that we lied during the day, there's no point here in saying, I'm never going to lie again, because we've just told another lie. So if it's something, a strong negative habit that we've done, then we can say simply, okay, for the next hour, I'm not going to do that thing. If that's way too difficult, for the next 10 minutes, I'm not going to do that thing. So pick an amount of time that with some effort, you can sort of manage. And then you can, over time, you can extend it from 10 minutes to 30 minutes to an hour, to a day, to a week, a month, the rest of your life. And so in that way, you can even break very strong negative habits. So if we do these four things, I mean, the best, of course, is to do them immediately having done some negative behavior during the day, to immediately regret, to reaffirm positive direction, a remedy, and then strong resolve not to do it again. But at least what we can do is do this review at the end of the day, and then particularly any heavy negative behavior, go through these four points. And that's a way of really letting go of them and really helping us to overcome that negative behavior. So that's very practical to do at the end of the day. But equally important, particularly in our modern society, is to focus on the good things we did during the day. Because unfortunately in our modern society, we tend to only focus on the negative. And not only do we only focus on the negative, we do that with cognitive fusion. We identify with all our negative stuff. No wonder we have an epidemic of low self-esteem and self-hatred in our modern society. So we need to have a balanced view of ourselves. In fact, on that point, the thing that reminds me is that the fact that we have so much imbalance in terms of focusing on the negative, there was another study that was done, and it was done in terms of couples in a relationship. I mean, normally you would think that if someone did a certain level of negative behavior towards their partner, to neutralize that, they would need to do an equal positive action. It would seem reasonable, no? But studies show that's not the case. Studies show that to neutralize the negative action that we do towards a partner, we need to do four or five equivalent positive actions to neutralize. That's how much we're focused on the negative. So it's very important at the end of the day to focus on the positive. Again, not with cognitive fusion. So we're not praising ourselves. We're not saying, oh, I was a wonderful person today. Because we're just going to get a big head and we're going to get a lot of pride and arrogance. So likewise on the positive side, as the negative, We don't identify with our positive behaviour. We simply look, review the day, and then we acknowledge any positive actions we did during the day. We rejoice in our behaviour. We don't praise ourselves. We rejoice in our behaviour. I was very happy to help that person at work today. So forth. So we need to rejoice in our positive behaviour, and that will strengthen our habit of engaging in that positive behaviour again the following day. So these are two things I think we can do at the end of every day. The next thing, the last thing we can do is when we go into bed, is we lie down in the corpse posture, the Shavasana posture, and we simply then practice some mindfulness of breathing. Just noticing sensations of the breath throughout the body, emphasizing relaxation. Particularly if we've had a very stressful, agitated day, we may have a lot of tension in our body and mind. So then by focusing on the sensations in the body, we're not only doing a shamatha practice of mindfulness, we are also releasing tension in the body and the mind. And this is a good way to transition into sleep, letting go of this stuff as well. If we're going to do that, it would be very good that in that corpse posture is to just use that for meditation, and then do that as long as you can maintain some mindfulness. When you start to become very drowsy, maybe after a few minutes or longer, then just mentally note, okay, my meditation is finished now, and then move out of that posture into whatever posture you use for sleep. So this is also a good way to end the day in terms of doing a little bit of mindfulness shamatha practice, releasing any tension, and then a good transition into sleep. So these are a couple of things that we can do then in the evening. So that's a little bit how we can set up our day. Just a couple more things before we finish up. Books related to these two practices that we looked at this weekend. The Shamatha practice, I can very much recommend this book from Alan Wallace, The Attention Revolution. He talks about the mindfulness of breathing, the looking at the mind, the awareness of awareness practice. He also has some chapters in here on loving kindness and compassion and Tonglen. He's also got a couple of chapters on lucid dreaming, dream yoga as well. So this, I think, is a very good book. If you're particularly interested in the looking at the mind or the awareness practice, he has another book called Stilling the Mind, coming from the Dzogchen tradition. So if you're particularly interested in those, that can also be a very good book, Stilling the Mind. And then today's practice of Vipassana, the emptiness practice, already mentioned, a very good book to read as a beginner there is How to See Yourself as You Really Are from His Holiness Dalai Lama. If you want to go a little bit deeper than that, in a little bit more depth into the whole dependent arising, emptiness and ignorance, there is another book called Insight into Emptiness. Insight into Emptiness. And the author is Kensir Jumpa Tekchok. That's very well written, and it really goes into this whole emptiness dependent arising in a very clear methodical way in quite some detail. Then in terms of also one other thing, I think it can be very helpful is not only having a daily practice, but if it's possible once or twice a year to attend a retreat, a group retreat. As a beginner, it's very much recommended to do group retreat, because trying to do solitary retreat for more than a day or two as a beginner, I think you're going to find it very difficult to have the discipline, and it's not guided and so forth. So I think it's very helpful as a beginner to attend group retreat once or twice a year if possible. That can really give us a boost in our practice, one that's really guided. So that can be very helpful. Also, then, of course, to attend more courses and teachings and so forth on these various topics as well. And also, I have my own website, glennsvenson.org, and on that website I have a number of courses and retreats that I've led, the audio for those, so you can also lots of material and lots of charts, so you can download that audio and have a listen to it. I've got a 9 or 10 day shamatha retreat. I've got what's called the Heart Sutra, which is really all about this emptiness, Vipassana practice, and there's a number of other things that's there as well. Also on my website I have a contact page, so if you want to contact me with any questions, then I'll try and help you out in whatever way I can. Also on my website I have my schedule in terms of where I'll be and what courses and retreats I'm running. Now, of course, for the next 4 months, I'm going to be up at Tushita Meditation Center in Dharamsala, running a number of introductory and intermediate courses, including Shamatha Retreat and so forth. So if you're interested in that, then the schedule is on the website there. So that's about all I wanted to say. We're just about running out of time, but is there any last questions before we finish up today? Yeah.
Yesterday I saw in the internet, Alan Wallace, I saw he has a CV and maybe more about meditations, guided meditations. Yeah. Is that useful as a beginner?
Yes. Alan Wallace has his own website, but he's heading up an organization called Santa Barbara Institute for Consciousness Studies, and their website is sbinstitute.com. And on there, he has a lot of podcasts. The audio from every year is running these 8-week, mainly shamatha retreats, but also loving kindness and compassion and so forth. And so all the audio is on there, and he also goes through very systematically. So you can then follow the audio from those retreats, and that can also be very good because he really starts from the very beginning and goes through all of these practices that we've done. The different shamatha practices, the loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, equanimity, tonglen, all these practices. Also in some of the retreats he goes into vipassana practice and other things as well. Some of them he even goes into dream yoga. So there's, for the last 3 or 4 years, a number of choices there you can look at. And it's all free, of course.
Do you need a guru in
your
spiritual
journey? So the question is, do we need a teacher in the spiritual path? Of course, historically, in ancient India and Tibet, if you didn't have a teacher, you couldn't begin because there were no books, we were probably illiterate, no access to anything. Without a teacher, giving personal instructions what to do. Now, of course, a bit different in our modern society, we've got lots of books and everything. So, of course, we can begin our spiritual practice and do the basic meditations and start the ball rolling. But of course, if we really want to dedicate ourselves to meditation and spiritual practice, then a teacher can save us a lot of time and make things very effective. Because even though we may have a good picture of the overall spiritual path, we're all different and individual. And so in all of these practices, what is the most effective thing for me to do now? I don't know. You know. So a personal teacher can really size us up, and they can really tailor the spiritual path according to our personal needs and abilities. And then also, if we sort of start to go wrong in practice, sometimes we don't realize that they can help us to overcome problems in wrong practice, and also if we face obstacles in our practice, to help us overcome that. So there are many advantages to having a personal teacher in our practice. But do we need a personal teacher to begin? No.
What about mixing it with, let's say, yoga?
Yeah, okay. So then mixing. So there is a little bit of a tendency in our modern society to do a little bit of this shopping. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, I like this bit from this tradition, this one from here, this one from here, and this one from here. Let's mix it all up and see what we get. Usually that's not good because each individual tradition or system is complete within itself and has a certain perspective. And so these practices work together from that perspective. Whereas different traditions may have different perspectives, and even though individual practices can be effective, they may actually even work against each other. So I wouldn't recommend just willy-nilly grabbing a bit from different traditions and mixing it all up. Rather, as a beginner, shop around, look around, find a tradition that resonates with you, and then when you find a tradition that suits you, dive into it. Stay within that tradition. If we become more advanced in that tradition, then it can be helpful to look a little bit outside the tradition to get more broader perspective. But if we don't have a clear perspective to begin with, and we just look everywhere, we just get confused. Because this one's saying this, but this is saying this, they seem to contradict each other. But often they're not contradicting, they just have different perspectives. But as a beginner, we don't see that. But having said that, then certainly, within Tibetan Buddhism, there's yoga, but usually it only comes at a very high tantric level. So I think in any tradition where we're talking about meditation and so forth, it's very important to do some physical body work. So if that tradition does not have some physical body work, bring it in. So I think there's no contradiction there if you want to follow Tibetan Buddhism and you're doing some yoga asanas or Tai Chi or Qigong or going swimming or going to the gym. In fact, there was a study done where they had two groups of Vipassana meditators with two teachers, and then over a 6-month period, one group did gym work as well as Vipassana, the other one just did Vipassana. The two teachers didn't know which group, they weren't told which group did the gym work. After 6 months, both teachers agreed the group that had done the gym work had progressed most in their Vipassana practice. So I think it's very important to do some sort of physical body work, whether it's gym work, jogging, swimming, yoga, Tai Chi, something. I think that's very important. We need to look after our body. Included in that, of course, is healthy diet. Healthy diet. You know, ADHD is huge now. Of course, there are many reasons. One of the great reasons, of course, is environmental conditions, diet, particularly sugar, overload sugar. You know, Coca-Cola, Coca-Cola, Coca-Cola. And then, you know, people wonder why they can't meditate and are so agitated. So we need to make sure we have a healthy diet as well. Any last question? Otherwise, yeah, last question. Sorry, I didn't catch what you said. Okay. So, of course, we can see people as our teacher in terms of going to their talks and classes, you know, and get general information from them. But when we talk about guru or personal teacher, we're talking about someone giving us personal advice. And here, the recommendation, of course, we need to check them out. We don't just jump in because we get, if they're not qualified, big mess. So we need to check them out. But the recommendation is to have only one. Because what often happens is if you have a personal teacher and you go for some advice, often the very advice that they give you is the one thing you don't want to do because it's the one thing you need to work on. And then you hear that and you go, oh, no, I don't want to do that. And then you run to another teacher. And they'll probably say the same, oh, no. And you keep running until you find a teacher that says something nice. Oh, yes, I'll do that. Not going to work. And, of course, the problem is if you go to two teachers for personal advice and they give seemingly contradictory advice, what are you going to do? And generally, if you go to a teacher to ask for personal advice, they may ask you, have you got a personal teacher? And if you say yes, they'll say, do what they told you. So, of course, to have a personal teacher, then they have to accept you as a student to give personal advice. But, of course, you can go and listen to the Dalai Lama and other teachers and Lama Zopa Rinpoche and so forth and just get general teachings from them. Well, I mean, to become his disciple means that you're going to ask for personal advice. So, generally, these high-level teachers will have many students. And another student is more work for them. So, you know, there's that point. And also, actually, historically, in ancient Indian Tibet, if a teacher took on a student, they also took on financial responsibility for that student as well. Nowadays, probably not, but in the past, yes. So, I mean, how that relationship develops can be a number of different ways. Of course, the first thing we need to do is check them out. So we can check them out by going to a number of their teachings and asking other people and so forth, and looking at their behaviour and so forth. And if we check them out and we feel that we want them to be our personal teacher, then we can go and ask, you know, would you please be my personal teacher? And then they may accept or not. One last thing, and then we really need to stop on that, but it's an important point, I think, is the relationship we have with a personal teacher is often likened to the relationship with a fire. If we have a fire and we're too close to the fire, we get burnt. If we're too far from the fire, we don't receive the warmth. Likewise, in a student-teacher relationship, if we're too close to them, we often get burnt. What that means is if we're seeing them every day, then because of our mental afflictions, often we'll start to project a lot of things onto them that's not true. We'll start to see a lot of faults in them that are not true. And also, if we see them every day, there can be this tendency to absolve personal responsibility, and whenever we have to make a decision, we run to the teacher, run to the guru. I know a guy who, whenever he wants to take a flight, he goes to his teacher, which flight should I take? I mean, come on, let's be serious. So what we need to do, of course, is if there's some important issue, then we can address it to the teacher. But of course, if we're too far from the teacher, we don't receive the warmth. So therefore, I think it's very helpful, if we have a personal teacher, to be able to see them personally at least a few times every year. In between times, if they've given us some instruction and we're having some problems or difficulties, usually if they're a well-known teacher, they'll have a lot of support people. We can send an email with our problem or question. They'll pass it on to the teacher, they'll remember us, they'll send a response, we'll get a response by email. So in between times, we can do that. Okay, let's stop there because we've run over time. So I'd just like to then finish by saying to thank CKSL for inviting me along here, looking after me very well. And then I'd like to then lastly, of course, thank all of you for making the time and effort to come here this weekend. And I hope that you received some benefit out of this weekend, and if you've got something to take home with you, then please don't merely leave it as some nice memory from the weekend, but use it to integrate into your daily life, to improve yourself and to help people around you as much as you can. So thank you very much.